All right. Hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill J. Karofsky presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Good morning, everyone. Have a seat. Excuse me a second. Thank you for your patience. We're here today for our second case, which is Heather Gudix versus Franklin Collection Services Incorporated. May I please have the appearances?
Member of the bar of DC and California. And
okay, welcome. Thank you. Thank you. And what I have today is Mr. Trevino, I have you starting with 25 minutes. Mr. Blythen, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes.
For 15 minutes, Ms. Goyne for 15 minutes, and Mr. Trevino for rebuttal. And are you both admitted pro hoc vice? Yes, okay, awesome. Thank you. Whenever you're ready, we can begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Andrew Trevino on behalf of Franklin Collection Services Incorporated. Both of the issues before the court are issues of first impression, and the statute at issue are untested, but they have been the subject of increased litigation. The Court of Appeals erred when analyzing both issues and both statutes. First, the Court of Appeals erred by only reading a portion of Wisconsin Statute 426.1104C of the Wisconsin Consumer Act and concluding that it is as silent as to who the creditor is to send the remedy to. The only way you can come to that conclusion is if you remove the phrase "to such parties" from Wisconsin Statute 426.1104C. Courts can't do that. Courts must read the entirety of the statute, which plainly states the remedy is to be sent to such party that sent the initial notice. Second, the Court of Appeals also erred in relying on Hornick to conclude the plaintiff has standing. In Hornick, the court did not address standing. Because standing is not a jurisdictional requirement, it is incorrect for a court to assume another court addressed standing unless it explicitly states so. Under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, a person must articulate an injury as a result of a violation to have standing to bring a claim. The facts of this case are simple. Ms. Gudix received a letter that she alleges violated the WCA by falsely threatening litigation. Although the substance of the issue of the letter is not at issue, it's important to note that the exact letter that's at issue in this litigation has been successfully defended by Franklin on motions to dismiss in at least seven district courts, including the Eastern District of Wisconsin twice. Although Ms. Gudix claims she was confused and feared a lawsuit, it's undisputed Ms. Gudix claims no actual damages or injury resulting from the alleged technical violation of Chapters 427. Franklin articulated a variety of arguments in support of its statutory interpretation argument in its brief, but today I want to focus on four of Franklin's main points. First, contrary to the lower court's decisions, 426.1104C is not silent with respect to whom a creditor needs to send a remedy to. Second, the rules of statutory construction all favor and support Franklin's interpretation of the statute. Third, Gudek's position is not supported by any language of the statute and is impractical. Fourth, the statute as a whole supports Franklin's interpretation.
So as you go through these things, can you address, as you do, which, if any, you think could be considered, for example, an affirmative defense or something that goes to merits? And if it's merits, how would that be resolved in light of McDaniels? So can you kind of weave that, both sides, weave that into your arguments so we can sort out merits decisions versus, for example, affirmative defense?
Sure. I think the 426.110 issue is not an affirmative defense because it's a pre-suit process. So it would occur before a lawsuit is in, it occur before the lawsuit is even filed and forecloses a class action for damages. I think standing is an affirmative defense, but I think given the posture of this case, it's important for the court to reach it because I don't think class certification can go forward unless the plaintiff has standing.
Interesting. Standing in the federal courts might be slightly different, right, than in the state courts. So can you expound on that for me?
Yes, standing is different in federal courts from state courts, in that, you know, we don't have Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, or Article 3 is different in Wisconsin, but it's still in Wisconsin, standing comes from common law. But as I mentioned, I still think standing needs to be or should be addressed before class is certified. But I also don't think we even need to arrive get to that issue in this case, because I think if the court agrees with our interpretation of 426.110, Ms. Gudek's claim should be dismissed. Before getting into my 4 points in detail, I think a brief summary of the process is helpful. And at the outset, I want to make it abundantly clear that this pre-suit and remedy process is not bad for consumers. It benefits both consumers and creditors. It allows consumers to get what they would in their best day in court without having to go through litigation. It gives both the customer or consumer and creditor the opportunity to resolve their dispute without the costs and delays associated with a lengthy class action or even an individual claim. The Wisconsin Consumer Act prohibits class action seeking damages unless customer plaintiffs follow a notice and remedy procedure and the customer's claim is unresolved. Under 426.110(1)(a), at least 30 days prior to the commencement of a class action for damages, any party must send a written notice of the particular alleged claim or violation and ask the creditor to correct or otherwise remedy the basis for the alleged claim. In turn, the creditor may remedy the particular alleged WCA violation to foreclose that customer from filing a damages class action. The specific language of 426.110(4)(c), and I'm paraphrasing, states, no class action for damages may be maintained if an appropriate remedy is given or agreed to be given to such party. If the remedy is agreed to be given or given, then no damages class action can be filed. The timing of this process is critical to understand. The demand must be made before and precludes the filing of a class action for damages. It's
counsel,
also
down here. In this case, it's clear that that demand was not made pre-suit, and therefore the defendant didn't have an opportunity to do a response pre-suit. That process occurred, as I understand it, after a motion to dismiss was litigated, and the motion did not seek dismissal under this provision. Does any of that matter, do you think, procedurally?
It certainly does. Because Ms. Gudek didn't comply with the statute, I think she's foreclosed from seeking damages. And so we couldn't raise this defense in response to the complaint because she didn't send the initial notice. So we could only respond once we had the notice. By sending the notice after a lawsuit was filed, it completely made this pre-suit process meaningless. It took away the defendant and the creditors right under the statute to seek a pre-suit resolution.
Did the defendant assert that as a basis for dismissal before it ultimately received the plaintiff's demand?
We didn't receive the plaintiff's demand until 9 months after she filed the complaint.
Right, that's what I mean. Did the defendant say, hey, circuit court, you need to dismiss this because she hasn't complied with this demand provision.
Yeah, when Ms. Gudek brought her motion for class certification, that was one of our arguments in response.
That was after, not before.
Correct.
Okay.
The plain language of the statute also provides that the notice and remedy process is exclusively between the creditor and the customer. Without class certification, there is no class. There can be no class-wide remedy before a class is certified. And the remedy cannot be binding on a potential class without class certification.
Where do you see that language in the statute, that exclusively between the, what did you say, the customer and the creditor? Yeah, where do you see that language, counsel?
Well, the language comes from 426.1104A. So that's the part, the initial party that sends the notice. And then...
And then 41A or 110 sub 1 says that that customer can bring action on behalf of him or herself and all persons similarly situated.
Right? Yeah, sorry, 426.1104A.
Oh, 4A.
So any at least 30 days or more prior to the commencement of a class action for damages pursuant to the provisions of this section, any party must. So that's a party to this pre-suit dispute. The only individual that was represented by counsel at that time and who sent this letter was Ms. Gudek. Ms. Gudek is any party. And then if you go to C, that's where it gets the creditor involved in responding.
Okay. So 4A says demand the person correct or otherwise remedy the basis for the alleged claim. And I guess my point is that the claim itself under sub one can assert the action on behalf of the customer and all persons similarly situated. So why is it that you're reading sub 4A2 saying the remedy, the basis of the claim as only narrowly focused on the customer and not the other person similarly situated? That's my understanding of how you're reading that provision.
So I think subsection 4.1 is like the scope section of 426.110, and that says that any customer, so you can bring a class action or you can bring an individual claim or class action under 426.110. So that does make sense because 4C is the notice and remedy for the individual claim. 4D actually provides a process for it's a creditor initiated process that allows them to resolve the case on a class action basis. So that's the 426.1101 is the scope, but if we go to 426.1104A, that's dealing with the individual party that to this pre-suit dispute that sends the notice.
Does prior to the commencement of a class action in 4A do any work there also?
Yeah, yes. I mean, that just means that it needs to be, they cannot file a class action until they do this. And it needs to be pre-suit. So
there's no action identified yet to identify any other potential parties.
Correct. Going to my first point, as I mentioned, contrary to the Court of Appeals conclusion, the statute is not silent with respect to whom the remedy is to be sent to under 426.110. The only way you can arrive at this conclusion is if you remove the word such party from the statute. The statute is clear in that the remedy is to be sent to such party that sent the initial notice. The plain language of the statute states no action for damages may be maintained under this section if the appropriate remedy is given or agreed to be given to such party. The Court of Appeals can't take those words out of the statute. That's for the legislature to do. My second point, the well-established rules of statutory construction favor and support Franklin's interpretation. And I want to point out here that there's not much response from Ms. Gudek to these arguments about statutory construction. But one rule of statutory construction is meaningful variation. If the legislature intended for an appropriate remedy under subsection 4C to be made to the potential class, it would have used the language in subsection 4D, referring to all customers similarly situated, instead of the language it chose in 4C. When a statute uses similar but different words, courts presume that those words have different meaning, and we must presume that a material variation in terms suggests variation in meaning. A review of the entirety of 426.110 demonstrates the legislature uses the word party to refer to the individual that's involved in this, that sends the notice in this pre-litigation.
And counsel, let me just direct you to some additional language in 426-1101. It looks like that permits either the customer affected by a violation or the administrator. I believe that's the administrator of the Division of Consumer Protection that's being referred to assert such claims. If it were the administrator, would they be such party making a demand? Does it apply in the situation if the administrator is being claims? And what does such party mean if the administrator is bringing claims?
I guess I'll just start. I don't think that issue is before the court, but I would say that the way the statute's read in a whole, that it wouldn't be the administrator, wouldn't be the party. So it's the parties to this pre-litigation dispute.
So wouldn't that demand be for some relief for persons affected, persons similarly situated, or otherwise a potential class? If it were the administrator.
Again, I don't think we need to decide that issue.
Well, I'm just asking how you interpret the statute. Are you saying that it only limits relief to the particular customer when it's the customer asserting the claims on their own behalf and on behalf of people similarly situated, and it would be applied and interpreted differently if it's the administrator bringing the claims?
I that's what the statute says. I think that they would be the party in this pre-suit dispute. So,
all right. So
are you saying it's applied the same or differently?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Wasn't the question, is it applied the same or differently if it's a party or the administrator?
Yeah, I think it would be applied the same. Again, I don't think we need to decide that issue. That one's not before the court today. Getting back to my statutory interpretation arguments, another rule of statutory interpretation is the statute should not be read in a way that renders another part of the statute meaningless. If subsection C were to be interpreted to require the creditor to make a class-wide offer, it would render subsection 4D completely meaningless. Subsection 4D gives the creditor the option to offer a remedy to all similarly situated customers after identifying them, notifying them of the proposed remedy, allowing them to opt in for relief, and seizing the alleged conduct. If a creditor chooses to exercise this option, it precludes the filing of a class action. Mandating a class-wide offer for the remedy under 426-1104C would render the 4D completely meaningless. Another rule of statutory construction that favors Franklin's interpretation is statutes aren't supposed to be interpreted in a way that would result in an unreasonable or absurd result. Here, because this is a pre-suit procedure and a proposed remedy or remedy sent to this proposed class would not be binding, it would be absurd for the legislature to create a statute that encourages a creditor to send a remedy without it being binding. It would not prevent any future suits. And again, the class isn't even existent at that time. And
counsel, it appears to me that the creditor in this case did in fact offer some relief to other persons similarly situated in response to the demand. They agreed that they would remove that language from their letter and not use it, not just with respect to Ms. Gudix, but other customers. Sure. And I believe they also agreed to some offered some language for an injunction at that stage.
That was part of their offer. The statute provides that you can either remedy or change the conduct. It's our position that they didn't need to include the offer for injunctive relief. That was just part of the offer.
All right. So they were not misinterpreting the statute in offering relief to respond to the allegations made by the plaintiff, not just on her behalf, but on behalf of other similarly situated persons. That just was out of the goodness of their heart. They didn't have to do that. They just decided to do it. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, parties can negotiate how they see fit, and that was part of the negotiation.
It's not required under the statute.
It is not required under the statute.
How would anyone even enforce that other than Ms. Gudex? So they agree not to send it to any other person in the universe. How would that be enforced?
How would we know they're not doing it?
Well, no one could enforce that if they sent it to someone else. How could anyone else? So it didn't apply to anyone other than Ms. Gudex. This idea that you kept referring to universal injunctive relief. Universal to who? It's not really universal injunctive relief.
Well, you know, I guess anyone that had accounts with my client, they stopped using that letter.
So. Well, I'm great, but they could have continued to use it. No one but Ms. Gudex could go to court and say this is the agreement, right?
Nothing would prevent another consumer who claims there is a violation of
the but this injunctive relief that was offered doesn't help those other people in any way, shape, or form, right?
Well, they weren't getting any more of this same letter, I guess. So
how do we know that? I mean, they couldn't come to court and say there's this. Are you saying that this injunctive relief is really enforceable by anyone other than Ms. Gudex?
I don't think they even needed to make the offer of injunctive relief. And I see where you're going, but I guess the only way you could tell is from the defendant saying in court under oath, you know, we're not using this letter anymore.
Okay, but I want to just hold on one second. How it matters, because you're right, it doesn't necessarily get to the issue, but it does matter to what can happen next, I think. So is it your position that no one else could seek an injunction, or that she can't seek an injunction now? This is just a suit for damages, right? This isn't an injunction. There's nothing about an injunction in her complaint at this point, right?
No, she brought a suit for damages and injunctive relief. And I would say her particular claim for injunctive relief is moot because we are no longer using the letter. I don't know what other injunctive relief we could offer.
But the remedy didn't have to include that.
That's correct.
Okay.
Was the creditor trying to foreclose the action continuing under sub E? Because the sub D provides that that offer of an appropriate remedy forecloses a claim of damages from proceeding, but not a claim for injunctive relief under sub E.
So the creditor didn't foreclose Ms. Gudex from bringing an action under 4E. It was Ms. Gudex that did. Under 4E, if you bring an action that seeks actual damages, you can't, 4E doesn't apply. 4E only applies to actions that seek injunctive relief. So by filing a complaint that asks for damages and injunctive relief, she wasn't going under 4E. So Ms. Gudex herself.
Wouldn't the effect be to, if this statute was properly invoked and the appropriate remedy was provided to that plaintiff, that the plaintiff could still proceed with her claim for injunctive relief under sub E? In other words, the damages claim is dropped, can't move forward, but the injunctive relief could?
That's correct. The remedy provided under 4C only forecloses the damages action.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to my third point, Ms. Gudex's position is not supported by any of the actual text of Wisconsin Statute 426.110 and is impractical. Apparently, Ms. Gudex also doesn't agree with the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the statute is sound with respect to whom a remedy is to be sent to, because she attempts to distance herself from the court's holding and ask for an alternative ruling. Ms. Gudex believes the trial court needs to be involved in determining who the remedy is to be sent to. Again, this statute isn't based on any of the language of the statute, or this argument isn't based on any language of the statute. It also doesn't make sense because at this pre-suit posture, a trial court isn't involved in the process. This would also defeat the purpose of the statute. If you're going to get the trial court involved, then there's no advantage of using this pre-suit procedure. Because there's no ambiguity in the statute, we need to apply the plain language, and the legislature used the word to such party. The legislature certainly could have established a procedure for trial court approval in a manner that is consistent with the review of an arbitration award or a minor settlement. However, that language isn't present in Statute 426.110 or any other statute. Fourth, Franklin's interpretation of Wisconsin Statute 1104C is consistent with the statute as a whole. Ms. Gudex, in her trial brief, has spent a lot of time talking about how the statute is to be liberally construed, but courts don't get to a liberal construction unless they find ambiguity. Second on that point, is there's nothing in the Consumer Act that says class actions should be favored as over individual actions. And if you actually look at the whole text of the Consumer Act, it suggests that the that individual actions are favored over class actions. The Wisconsin Consumer Act imposes hurdles, limitations, and prohibitions on class actions that aren't present for individual actions. In individual action, you can in an individual action under the WCA, you can recover broader remedies, you can recover more attorney's fees. And there's certain claims that you can't bring as a class action unless there's DFI guidance directly on points, or there's a Court of Appeals decision directly on points. And one other aspect of the WCA that is important to understand in light of the Court of Appeals policy discussion when they cited the case Hardwood, they explained that for some class actions, a policy reason for allowing them to go forward is that there's a small amount of money at issue, so that can disincentivize plaintiffs from bringing claims. The WCA is a fee-shifting statute, so it eliminates that concern. Even if there's a nominal amount at issue, if a plaintiff prevails, they get their attorney's fees. So that concern is eliminated by this tool in the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Because Franklin offered Ms. Gudeck's complete relief under statute 426.110, this court does not need to reach the standing issue. The court should reverse the Court of Appeals and hold that Ms. Gudeck's motion for class certification must be must be denied, and her individual claim must be dismissed because it's moot.
So on a standing,
I was going to ask the same thing. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask on the standing question. What exactly would you what should have been alleged that would have satisfied standing?
Excuse me. Repeat that. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, good. What should have been alleged to satisfy standing in your view?
Thank you. We need to apply the plain language of the statute. There's a bunch of different tests that the courts of appeals use when analyzing standing. But one thing that's agreed on is when a statute is at issue, you start with the language of the statute. The statute here says a person injured by a violation of the statute may bring a claim. So they must articulate an injury. The statute doesn't say any person confused. The statute doesn't say that any person that is scared or is fears of something as a result of violation.
Well, counsel, doesn't it reach emotional distress or mental anguish under 427.105?
Yes.
So why is it not appropriate to categorize those claims of confusion? She thinks she needs to call a lawyer. She's afraid. Why is that not an injury under those emotional harms, given that those are expressly recoverable?
I'm out of time. May I respond?
Yes,
please do.
Here, Ms. Gudeck did not assert a claim for emotional damages. And there's no Wisconsin courts that have addressed whether a plaintiff has standing for a violation of a consumer, alleged consumer violation in connection with claiming confusion or fear. For that reason, and guidance directly on the Wisconsin Consumer Act saying that we should refer to federal case law on standing, federal courts have looked at this. And all federal courts that have looked at a case where a plaintiff only claims confusion have found that that does not constitute an injury. The same goes with fear of a lawsuit or even hire an attorney. And I guess my last point, Ms. Gudeck hasn't cited any case where confusion or fear alone is enough to satisfy an injury.
Why does she, do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask the question.
Okay, why does she need to allege anything? This is a statute. It provides a penalty if they've done wrongdoing by sending an inappropriate letter. And as you just talked about, it fee shifts in terms of attorney's fees. Where in Wisconsin law, I mean, I get what you're saying about federal courts, but a statute alone can provide the basis for standing under Wisconsin law. Otherwise, can't your clients send these letters to anybody they want and continue to do so in violation of the law with no one's ability to enforce them?
So I think we have to apply the language of the statute. The statute doesn't say anyone who claims a violation of the statute can bring a claim. It says any person injured by a violation. So they need to articulate an injury to bring it. That's what the plain language of the statute says.
So you're saying they have to have some kind of damages. I don't see the statute saying that.
Damages and injury are not the same, aren't the same thing.
Right. So what are you saying she has to do?
She needs to articulate an injury, which means she did something federal court.
Isn't her injury that you violated the statute?
No, because that's not what 426 or 427-105 state. It doesn't say any person who claims a violation of the statute has a cause of action. It says any person who's injured. I think we need to apply the plain language of the statute.
But it does say by a violation of this chapter. That's the injury.
It says, I don't think it says that's the injury. It says any person injured by a violation of this chapter may recover actual damages and the penalty provided.
Right.
So they need to articulate an injury.
Okay.
Thank you for your time and questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm John Blythen on behalf of Heather Gudex. Didn't mention this before, but generally, Ms. Goyen plans to speak on the standing issues, and I plan to speak on the 426 issues. I hope that's okay. This is my first time arguing here.
That works for us.
So the case asks whether Franklin's individual-only offer to Mrs. Gudex provided an appropriate remedy under 426.110. Both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals said no, and they were correct for several reasons. First, Franklin's offer provided no class-wide relief. Two, admitted costs, reasonable attorney's fees, and punitive damages entirely. Three, the pre-suit notice arguments were in our position forfeited multiple times in this case. Their position and the amicus's arguments are inconsistent with the text structure and purpose of the WCA. So the statute requires a defendant, to provide an appropriate remedy. If the creditor provides an offer before the case starts, if the creditor offers something before the at any point here, and there's a dispute over whether it's appropriate relief, the Circuit Court is the one to answer whether the relief is appropriate, right? Because Even assuming that the 426.110.4a is a pre-suit procedure, what happens realistically is the client comes in,
counsel, I'm going to ask you to help me with the statute a little bit, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at subsection D of 426.110 sub 4, correct? And that's all about the class-wide relief. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be odd for that subsection right above it in C to also be about class-wide relief? And why or why not?
No, Your Honor, I think subsection C and D are different things. So subsection C is initiated by the consumer, and subsection D is initiated by the creditor. So the Department of Financial Institutions says to them, hey, what you're doing here in this particular letter violates the Consumer Act. You should change it, or we're going to fine you or take your license or something. And then they can go and figure out who they sent that letter to, and essentially do a class remedy without a class action being on file by an opponent. Section C doesn't say whether it should be an individual offer or not. It says it should be appropriate relief. Our position isn't that appropriate relief always means class or always means individual. Appropriate relief has to be appropriate under the circumstances. Here, Franklin sent this letter to 12,000 other people during the class period. It's a form letter. The violation is the same in every letter. Every person has the same injury to their legal interest by receiving this letter. Each person would be entitled to statutory damages if they came forward, but most people, the purpose of a class action is because a lot of those people will not realize that they've had a statutory harm.
I want to go back to what I think you said when you were laying out your argument, and you said that Franklin's offer did not include attorney's fees, costs, or I don't know if you said damages, or if you said punitive damages, or if you said damages and you meant punitive damages. But I don't see that in the statute. So do you think that an appropriate remedy needs to under the statute needs to include attorney's fees, costs, damages, punitive damages?
Under the circumstances, it would in this case. The WCA itself specifically authorizes punitive damages. I guess my point here, for the most part, is that it can't be. I mean, there could be an award of punitive damages under this circumstance. Franklin has been using this letter for quite some time. I found a case that my firm had sued them for the exact same language in 2014. Where are we?
Because there could be an award, does that mean that they have to?
It doesn't necessarily mean they have to, but...
Okay, because like the statute says shall include actual damages and may include penalties.
Right, may include penalties, but you can't... that doesn't eliminate, I don't think that eliminates punitive damages. It's just not.
The argument is though that they don't have to. Is that your same argument regarding the attorney's fees and the costs, that they should, but they don't have to?
Not exactly. In this case, the case had been going forward for a while before, under a theory that there's two claims in this, the FDCPA federal claim and the Consumer Act claim. And the idea was that she would be seeking injunctive relief under the Consumer Act and money damages under the FDCPA. Our position was that the FDCPA, the federal statute, has its own remedy section that does not require a pre-suit notice. That is 15 USC 1692 KA. Does not require any sort of pre-notice requirement.
Can I just clarify real quick?
Sure.
With respect to I'm back on the attorney's fees and costs, because I didn't hear the answer to my question. Where in the statute do you think that has to be as an appropriate remedy? What language are you using to get there?
Generally, 427, 105, I think it's 105.
Did you say 427?
Yeah. 427,
105.
Okay, but I'm looking at this pre-suit offer under 4A. I'm sorry, 4C. Yes. So where in there?
Well, it's in 427.105, a person injured by a violation of the debt collection chapter may recover actual damages and the penalty provided in 425.304, but not with, and then goes on about the attorney's fees, and then it goes on. Sorry. Emotional distress issue.
Okay, but I'm still back to the C in this pre-suit offer, essentially, this appropriate remedy that's given.
If we're going to write a holding in this case, and we are going to discuss the language of 426.1104C. It's my understanding that your argument is that an appropriate remedy would include attorney's fees, costs, and punitive damages. Is that what you're asking us to hold in this case? What are you asking us to do? That an appropriate remedy must include that.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that an appropriate remedy may include that. And in this court, in this case, both the circuit court and the Court of Appeals made the determination that the offer that they made was not is not an appropriate offer.
I understand that, but how is anyone supposed to know? Like, what is the where's the line? How are they supposed to know? Why?
I'm not sure where you draw the line on that. I mean, I can say in situations like this where they've sent 12,000 of these letters to people, an appropriate remedy can be a class-wide remedy, and they can give that class-wide remedy to the party that's bringing them the letter pre-suit.
Wait, there's no class though. If there's no class, is there a requirement for a class-wide remedy?
They can then do that. Go under, you know, the D provision and what.
But under C, isn't C supposed to be there to allow parties to try to remedy wrongs or issues that could be litigated without the need for further litigation, without the need for a class being certified, expediting resolution, and ultimately, whether lawyers like it or not, reducing litigation costs? Right? That's part of the purpose of C.
I think that is sort of the purpose of it, but that is applied differently depending on the circumstances of the case. For example,
it seems to me the interpretation that the court below gave C effectively eliminated that notice and opportunity and, I don't know why anyone would want to enter into an early settlement given that interpretation.
Well, so there's different kinds of cases like this. In the Consumer Act, for example, you have a situation where you have a repossession that's allegedly illegal. You have somebody who's received too many phone calls. An appropriate remedy in that particular type of case might be an individual offer to that person, right? But here they've in order to have the regulatory function of this statute apply and have any use, you can't have people buying off each individual person. There has to be a remedy for all the other people that got this letter.
Can she still do that through an injunctive action? Barred from pursuing that still?
We are, but they say they're not using the letter anymore. I mean, obviously, the time has passed since we've been in the Court of Appeals and in this court, but we don't know that because that would be something that's done in discovery.
Well, but people all the time sort of settle disputes without admitting that they were wrong, but it creates a resolution for that day, for that suit with that person, and potentially provides relief to people in the future. I mean, that's not uncommon in litigation and in settlements.
No, but in this particular circumstance, there are, Ms. Gudex is representing a whole class of 12,000 other people whose rights were violated by this, by receiving this letter.
Under C?
Under C. And here we should understand where these cases are. The court of this
what's the A party language mean?
I'm sorry, couldn't.
Does the a party language mean anything in particular?
Well, the important language, I will get to it, I promise. The important language in my is appropriate relief. You can give appropriate relief, you know, to, you know, essentially a class under C or D, you know, and the court can determine whether an offer is an appropriate offer or not, and that's what they did here, and that's a discretionary.
All those other people that would then receive the offer where there's no current class, right? Where's the protection for the creditor once they do whatever it is you say they have to do?
Under D, they would be, I mean, that would be a way that they could do it. They could also, you know, stipulate to a class action.
Well, hold on. So now when the creditor wants to provide an offer to the person who's making the claim under C and wants relief under C, they have to agree to attorney's fees, costs, and punitive damages, and agree to convert it to a class action.
That's not necessarily what they'd have to do, but in this circumstance, you know, there already was a case. It was being litigated under, you know, the FDCPA and the WCA as well, and all I was saying before was that sort of stipulating to a class action settlement is a way that they can do that without, you know, while limiting the litigation, right? I've actually had class actions where before it was even filed, there was an agreement to settle. And it just goes through the quick process of notice and payment, and then then there's a judgment.
Is that what happened here?
No, this case is still going on. Yeah, I'm sorry, my time is up.
I do just have a follow-up. If this court disagrees with the Court of Appeals interpretation regarding whether the relief needs to be given to the whole putative class or the individual party in this case, how does that affect your argument? And what would you say that, how does a court determine whether appropriate relief has been given if we start with that premise?
Well, it's a specific, it's a very sort of flexible idea whether relief is appropriate.
And by that, do you mean it's something that the trial court finds? Like, what is an appellate court supposed to do? You cited the Court of Appeals, you know, decision with some agreement, but what is an appellate court supposed to do when we're looking back at in determining whether is appropriate? Do you think we owe some deference to a trial court determination whether it's appropriate? Is this a question we look separately and say, well, there was an offer to make, you know, your client whole, even if it didn't include punitive damages? I mean, what how do you say we make that determination?
I think it's a discretionary decision of the trial court, as well, both the merits and class certification itself is also a discretionary decision. And that's where we are right now on an interlocutory appeal of class certification decision. My time is still up, so.
Okay. Chief, may I ask one other question?
Please.
Is there a relationship between sub 4A, or I'm not sure I'm looking at the right provision. Yeah, A, the demand that's made, and then the appropriate remedy. In other words, if the plaintiff is, does the plaintiff have to demand specifically the relief that they believe is appropriate and necessary to not
yes.
move forward?
Sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt. On 4A2, the demand that such person correct or otherwise remedy the basis for the alleged claim, you know, they, in this case, you know, if they stop using the letter and they provided something to, you know, some amount.
Did you specifically request those things in the demand? And did you request attorney fees?
Yeah, I believe we did. I'm not 100% sure, because I've taken over this case kind of in the middle.
Thank you.
Sir.
Attorney Goyim.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Lucia Goyne. I represent Ms. Gudex. Thank you for the courtesy of allowing me to argue here today. I'm focusing on the second question on which this court granted review, whether a person like Ms. Gudex, who alleges that she received a misleading debt collection letter under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, has standing to bring that claim. The Wisconsin Constitution confers jurisdiction in circuit courts to hear all matters, civil and criminal. Franklin hasn't overcome the presumption that Ms. Gudex has standing to sue. Ms. Gudex alleged a violation of a statute enacted by the Wisconsin legislature, and no more is required to establish her standing, either by that statute or by the Wisconsin Constitution.
Could you address just the textual argument that a person injured by a violation of this chapter under the remedy section 427.105, which suggests that there could be a violation of this chapter and a person not be injured, doesn't equate a violation of the chapter with an injury. So it suggests there needs to be something textually. So what is that in your view?
Absolutely. Well, when faced with questions of statutory standing like this court is here, starting with the text makes sense. And the plain dictionary definition of the word injury, I'm looking at Black's Law Dictionary, is the violation of another's legal right for which the law provides a remedy. So the plain dictionary definition of injury is just the violation of a legal right. So another way to read 427.105 is a consumer who has had their rights violated may sustain an action for damages and the penalty in 425.304.
So your argument, just let me rephrase it. I may just be repeating exactly what you just said, but just for my own sake. Your argument is if there has been alleged to be a violation of that chapter, that is always and everywhere an injury, regardless of any consequences to the consumer, regardless of any anguish or fear or anything. It is just always an injury.
For purposes of 427.105, when a consumer asserts that their rights have been violated, that's an injury under that statute. And, you know, we make an alternative argument that confusion and those types of harms that are flow and are naturally foreseeable from the harms by the statute are independently sufficient, but I don't think the court has to reach the question if it agrees on the first point.
Well, counsel, I'm looking at 426.110 sub 1, which says that a customer affected by a violation of the consumer code can bring the civil action. Does that affected by language imply some form of injury, or how do you interpret that phrase?
Absolutely. Well, reading the two provisions in harmony means just a violation of law, because otherwise, if this court were to read those two terms differently, it would be facing.
Sure, but it has to be a violation affecting them personally, right? So a person who did not receive the particular letter in this case with the objected to language could not file an action. Is that correct?
That's right, but I don't think that that would be a result of 426.110. I think they would also be precluded by 427.105 because
right.
They're not
so
a person injured.
They have to show some personal stake or interest in getting that action declared in violation of the statutes.
Yes, absolutely. And just to be clear, that is the if this court is looking to fully Chikantelli to set out kind of its standing analysis, that's the first prong I read. The question presented is falling within the second prong, kind of like whether the statute allows a person who suffers a violation or pleads a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act has suffered a legal interest. But I do think that there are other parts of the standing analysis that would cabin who could bring up a claim, like the first prong of the analysis, which is the personal affect, personal stake, or the third, judicial policy. Turning back to the text of the statute, there's other provisions that support this reading. As Justice Crawford pointed out, 426.110 allows a class to be initiated by any consumer affected. And just as a consumer can seek actual damages in the penalty under 427.105, the same is true of a class initiated under 426.110. Turning to the substantive provisions of the Act, as we point out in the briefing, most of the acts that the Wisconsin Consumer Act bans won't result in actual damages or measurable injury. For example, 427.104A bans threats of force or physical violence, threats of criminal prosecution. Later in the substantive provisions of the statute, the act bans communicating in a manner with such frequency or at such unusual hours that can be reasonably be expected to harass, or using obscene language. Many of these acts, in fact, most of them, won't naturally result in the type of heightened injury, in fact, that Franklin asks this court to read into the statute, which supports the plain definition of injury to just mean the violation of another's legal right rather than anything beyond that. I think the same is underscored by the availability of the penalty itself, also in 427.105. That provision allows Ms. Gudex and other consumers like her to recover actual damages and the penalty. And as this court noted, actual damages are defined to include intangible harms like emotional distress and mental anguish. But that allows the penalty to recover for situations where a consumer pleads intangible harms that don't naturally lead to damages flowing from emotional distress.
I just want to go back to this, the text again. A person injured by a violation, a person affected by a violation, just as a matter of plain English, that suggests a violation does not equate to an injury or being affected by. I mean, the sentence doesn't make any sense. And if it says there has to be some injury, right, in order to be entitled to the remedy in that situation, or affected by. Maybe affected by is broader, I don't know, and maybe that constitutes, but it your argument is that you're automatically injured if you get something, but I guess just textually it doesn't seem from the language to follow to me.
Well, two things. Our argument isn't injured in all cases always means a violation. It's really just confined to this specific statute in the context of the Wisconsin Consumer Act and, you know, the intrinsic parts of the act. But I would say the plain meaning of injury in Black's Law Dictionary, which is the source that this court turns to when looking to plain meanings, is the violation of another's legal right. So reading the sentence just with its plain dictionary definition reaches the conclusion that Ms. Gudex asks this court to hold, just that the statute requires a violation of another's legal right and nothing beyond that. And that was true at the time that the Wisconsin Consumer Act was passed, and even more true in federal law at the time. Injury, in fact, at that time, even under stricter Article III standards that don't apply to this court, meant legal injury, even if the consumer hadn't suffered an injury outside of the violation of the legal statute.
Do you agree that do you agree with the general statement that the federal standing law works differently for identical language, or do you think there's any difference?
For identical language?
Yes.
It depends. I think if there's a pure question of substantive interpretation of a statute in federal law entirely divorced from the question of standing, then, you know, the court could look to federal law. But I agree with the proposition that and a case interpreting Article III principles and standing under the FDCPA isn't going to be useful to this court in interpreting the pure question of state law here, whether a consumer under the Wisconsin Consumer Act has standing under this particular provision.
Well, suppose I think it is useful. What do you think about it?
Well, to the extent it's useful, I think this court's decision in Nicolau provides some helpful guidance as to when courts can look to federal standing law or federal law in general. There, this court, in interpreting the bona fide error of law provision of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, looked to the Truth in Lending Act, and it said it was doing so for two reasons. First, because the language of the provision that it was interpreting was identical. And second, because the application of federal precedent supported the purposes of the Wisconsin law. And neither of those two circumstances apply here. There's no identical federal law provision that we're looking to, and application of these stringent Article III requirements to the case here would undermine the purpose of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, which is to protect consumers. I would just make one more note on that point. I don't concede that Ms. Gudex, with these facts, wouldn't have standing in federal courts. And I think to the extent there's any doubt about that, I think this court could look directly to TransUnion, which is the case that Franklin cites for the proposition that standing has been significantly narrowed. In that case, there was a series of claims, but in one particular claim, a class of consumers alleged that they had received a series of mailers that were formatted incorrectly in violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And the court explicitly said that it wasn't disturbing the named plaintiff's standing and he had alleged that he was confused, distressed, and relied on the information in that incorrect mailer. And the court said there's no reason to disturb the lower court's conclusion on Ramirez's, the named plaintiff's, standing. So, you know, I think even under these stringent requirements, interpreting analogous consumer statutes and federal law, TransUnion itself supports that confusion can be a downstream consequence of a misleading debt collection letter.
Did your complaint allege that she was injured? And I'm defining injury under the state standing requirement, which is adversely affected, which is a broader concept than injury under the federal standard. Was there something in the complaint alleging that her interests were adversely affected? How was it framed?
Yes, well, I guess in two ways. So first, she alleges that she personally received this debt collection letter, that it violated provisions of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. And under our first standing argument, we think that's sufficient. But on the alternative standing argument, if this court wants to look at downstream consequences, the allegations are that she read the letter and was confused about whether Franklin could or would sue. That's in paragraph 22. As a result of receiving and reviewing the letter, she feared she might be sued. She brought the letter to her attorneys, paragraph 23.
So the complaint did include those allegations of fear and confusion.
Yes, and I would add she also alleged that she had to spend time and money investigating the letter and the consequences of any potential responses in paragraph 51.
Okay.
So are you saying that's the injury alleged, or are you sticking with an allegation of violation is the injury?
The violation of the using the plain dictionary definition of the term injury, our first argument, and we'd ask this court to adopt that, and a violation of a statute under 427.105 is sufficient for standing.
That's a little bit chicken and egg though, isn't it? Because don't you have to show there was a violation, or do you just have to allege it?
Yes, and in cases of statutory standing where the interpretation of the statute matters, sometimes whether a plaintiff has stated a claim will fall and rise with whether they have standing. So if for example, I mean, the circuit court here in the motion to dismiss concluded that Ms. Gudex had stated a claim. So the question for the court today is conditional on the fact that she stated a claim, is she a person injured within the meaning of the statute? But in a situation where a court concludes that she hasn't stated a claim, she obviously hasn't suffered an injury, because even if she's pled a violation of a legal right, if she loses on that claim, she has no violation of a legal right.
Isn't that where this would belong then, is a motion for failure to state a claim upon which relief is granted?
Could you repeat that?
Wouldn't that be the way that this would get dismissed potentially? I mean, I know there are statutory penalties here, but under your reasoning, the place to do that, it's not at standing, it's at the point in which whether there's been a claim.
Yes.
Failure to state a claim would be the motion that would, failure to state a claim would be the motion brought.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And if she had lost on the motion to dismiss, then the question of standing would have been resolved.
So when would someone bring that?
The standing argument?
Or the motion to dismiss or failure to state a claim?
I mean, it was alleged during the motion to dismiss briefing here. Franklin did argue in the context of that she didn't have standing to pursue her claim, and then separately argued that she hadn't stated a claim because the letter itself wasn't misleading, and the circuit court addressed both points.
And the circuit court denied them, and it was not appealed.
That's right. The appeal right now is an interlocutory appeal from the grant of class certification.
Based on the class certification.
That's correct.
But does it belong part of the class certification issue, or does that become marriage based? I look back at McDaniel and try to, that's what I asked from the beginning, and I'm still searching for the answer. So
I don't read the standing question as being an affirmative defense. It's just a question here, at least it's a question of statutory standing. It's whether a consumer has pled a claim, and part of that is whether they've pled a violation to the claim. I'm assuming Franklin doesn't admit the portion of the violation portion of the statute in order to dispute whether she has an injury. But I do think, and turning to the first part of your question, which isn't the proper place to put this in the motion to dismiss, that's why prior to the petition for review, in the briefing in the Court of Appeals, Ms. Gudex took the position that the issue wasn't properly before the Court of Appeals because it hadn't been independently raised. The issue of standing hadn't been independently raised in the class certification briefing.
So is your argument now that it's inappropriate for us to address?
No, the response to the petition states that it would be helpful to have this court's view of TransUnion, especially in light of the recent developments in federal law and the fact that the court does occasionally look to federal law. Because standing is not jurisdictional, this court could reach it or decline to reach it.
It is it's just an odd posture since this is a motion. This is an interlocutory appeal of class certification. It's an odd place to deal with something like that.
With standing, yes.
Yeah,
that's right. I agree. I see my time is up, but I want to make sure that I answer any other questions that the court may have.
I don't see any more. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Attorney Trevino, rebuttal, please.
Thank you. I want to start in response to a few arguments made regarding statutory interpretation. There's a few arguments made regarding getting the trial court involved, attorney's fees and damages, and supposed flexibility in the statute. A common theme underlying all of these arguments is that they're not based on the language of the statute. There was questions asked about which portions of the statute those arguments are based on, and there was no pointing to the actual language of the text. That means that the only way the court could follow Gudex's interpretation is if it were to rewrite the statute by either replacing words or inserting words. The courts can't do that. That's for the legislature to do.
The trial court and the class certification, which we generally review for an erroneous exercise of discretion, right? So is your argument at the end of the day that it was legal error because it thought the remedy was not appropriate because it required it to be class-wide? Is that, in other words, I'm trying to figure out like our actual standard of review and how we decide this case. This is a little confusing in thinking about what's appropriate or not. But the trial court said, you know, you need to offer it to, you need to offer it to the whole class. That wasn't there. And we're going to certify the class. And you're saying, hey, that's not correct. It actually should be to this individual plaintiff in this situation. That's the such party in the statute. And therefore we should reverse it as an erroneous exercise of discretion. Am I trying to follow the logic here and the appropriate standard of review? Please correct any of that I'm missing.
Yeah, I think under either. So I think the standard of review here, although we're on a motion for class certification, because we're reviewing 426, it's an issue of statutory interpretation, which this court reviews de novo. Even if this court is going to look for the other standard, abuse of discretion, which you just articulated, I think is the error. The trial court erred in concluding that this should be a class-wide offer.
Yeah, I mean, typically erroneous exercise of discretion requires at least an application of the correct law. So right, I think what you're arguing is it was inappropriately reading the statute and therefore applied the wrong law and therefore was an erroneous exercise of discretion. Am I understanding that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And that's really that's really the legal rubric. Is there any, because I don't know that do we need to go on to what's appropriate or inappropriate? Does it need to include punitive or not punitive? Like it feels like, I mean, all that stuff's interesting and maybe hard, but in the context of the procedural posture of this case, I'm not sure we need to get to that.
Right, I agree. The language of the statute plainly states that it's to include actual damages and penalties. The text of 426 establishes that an appropriate remedy does not include additional damages. Under one of the basic rules of statutory interpretation, the expression of one thing here, actual damages and optional penalties, means the exclusion of others. By stating what an appropriate remedy includes, the legislature excluded other types of damages, such as attorney's fees and punitive damages.
But do we need to get, I thought you just told me we didn't need to get to that. I'm trying to figure.
I don't think we need to reach that for those reasons, sorry. I don't think I understood your question correctly.
Because at the end of the day, you're just saying the trial court wrongly certified the class because it was relying on this reading of the scope of the, making appropriate relief.
Right. And at that stage, the plaintiff was foreclosed from bringing a class action for damages because she did get an appropriate offer with complete relief.
Okay.
Is it us that we would decide, though, that that's appropriate relief? Isn't that still somewhat a factual determination that would need to be made by the trial court?
Can you rephrase that again? Sorry.
Would you want us to decide that it was appropriate relief? Wouldn't that still be something that would have to go to the trial court? for example, there's an issue here potentially about damages, whether she has any. I mean, it's include actual damages. So if that's what the offer has to include, do you want us to say that that has been met, or is that something that would normally go back to the trial court for proof?
I think it's undisputed that she doesn't have any actual damages. I haven't heard her articulate any actual damages.
I think it's being disputed. Aren't they saying there's potentially some kind of emotional distress? And whether that's true or not, isn't that something that would the trial court would determine that?
There's no claim for emotional distress. She's claiming confusion and fear.
Okay, so you want us to also make a finding that that's not enough? Is that what you're asking? I understood this to be what Justice Hagedorn was saying is, this wasn't properly certified, but wouldn't it go back to the trial court at that point? And they can make determinations about actual damages and whether that's been appropriately brought.
I'm out of time here. Can I answer your, can you rephrase that? Sorry, I don't think.
Can I try?
Yeah, please.
I think if you follow the thread from what you agreed to with Justice Hagedorn, Justice Hagedorn took you to the place of the circuit court inappropriately applied the statute, and that was the error that the circuit court made, right? It was a legal error. They interpreted the statute incorrectly. So take that thread over to Justice Dallet. Justice Dallet is saying, now what happens next? Does it go back to the trial court with now the benefit of this court's statutory analysis? And do they then apply the law without the error? Or are we supposed to figure out whether or not this was an appropriate remedy using the correct application of the statute?
Thank you.
Right. So I think because we provided the appropriate remedy, it would get reversed, and Ms. Gudex would be precluded from bringing a class action for damages. I know she also asserted part of the class action was for injunctive relief. So
I understand that you believe that you provided the appropriate remedy. Are we supposed to decide that, or does it go back to the circuit court to decide that? I know what you
think. I think this court can decide it based on using the well-known principles of statutory construction and the plain language of the statute.
Okay. Were there any questions, follow-up?
No.
But, no, I'm good.
Yes? No? Okay, I'm taking that as a no, Justice Hagedorn.
I'm good.
Thanks. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
No?
That's enough.
Okay. thanks to everybody. We'll be adjourned. The court will reconvene at 1:30 in closed session.
Of course. Okay. I just sense that we